Okay. My name is Gabriel. I am 16 years old. Today's date is November 23rd, and I'm speaking with my Uncle Fi. We are recording this interview in Austin, Texas. So, talk about how did we first meet?
We first met when your mom brought you home and you were just an infant. You were a baby because you were just born. And we met you at Gloria's parents' house on Garden Street in Austin. And that's because at that time, we were about 16. Okay, so we were engaged to be married. And so we go over, of course, and we wanted to meet you because you were the new addition to the family. But yeah, you were just an infant. You were just a newborn when we first met you.
Okay.
And it was at her house. It was up there. And then we went again to go, like a first birthday party for you at your grandma's house on Willow. I think it was called Willow. But the very first time was on Garden Street. You were just a baby.
Yeah. What is your favorite memory of me?
Of you?
Yeah.
Well, I got a few good ones. But I think the one that really stands out, the one that I really enjoyed, was when you caught that alligator gar. Because you were happy. You were smiling. There was a huge, you could tell that you enjoyed it. You enjoyed that you were able to catch a fish that size, because it was a good size, which was like 3 feet long or something like that. It was huge.
Snapped the wire and
Yeah.
everything.
So yeah, that's the one that stands out the most. The ones that I do remember also, not necessarily my favorite, but you were just a baby. I don't remember how old you were when your dad died, but I saw you there, and it's obvious that you didn't understand what was happening,
Right.
and that was really sad. But not my favorite memory, but definitely is, something that stands out. And then I think there were times when I saw you questioning, "Where is he?" Again, not favorite memories, but you have to see that. But I guess my most favorite joyous memory would be the catching of the fish.
Right.
That was a good one.
Yeah, that was a pretty fun day.
Yeah.
So, can you tell me a bit of your childhood? What you were like as a child?
Okay. I grew up in East Austin. I went to Brook Elementary, and I remember in the third grade, I was in Ms. Rodriguez's class, and I was voted Brook best, like the best student, and for the third grade, for the third grade, and so I was proud of that, because I got a little medal that went with, that I was a really good student. Grew up very, very poor, and I mean that in the most sincere way, very, very poor. Life was hard. I didn't realize that much, that it was hard, until you start grow a little bit older and you realize, wow, okay, I was really poor. But that's just the way life was, I didn't know that we were poor. I didn't know. As far as a child, I knew I had a mom. But I wasn't raised by my mom, and I know I had a dad, because obviously you can't be born without a dad, but I've never met my dad. It wasn't too much later, like in my 20s, that I set out to learn to meet my mom and to get to know her. And my mom loved to fish, so we did a lot of fishing trips to the coast and then some local trips here in Austin. But that was the way that I reached out to meet my mom, to get to know my mom, because I didn't really know my mom. Like, I didn't know my brother. I have a brother and I have a sister, and I didn't know them until I was 18. Okay, and today my brother and I are really close. Not real close to my sister. My grandparents raised me, and then when I was 7, they put me into the Big Brother Big Sister program, and I got a big brother. And I had my my big brother was my big brother with me until I turned 18. Mm-hmm. But when I was 12, I had an uncle who lived there with my grandparents with us, and he was very abusive. And for some reason, there was this machismo that he had. You know what machismo is?
No, I don't. What is that?
Machismo is like a manly way of trying to raise children, child. Like they got to make you a man. The way they make you a man is they beat you.
It's very stern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't have a. It's not a love and compassion and teaching. Mm-hmm. It's pow. You know, here's the blow to the head.
Yeah.
And so when I was 12, I had enough of that. Because it happened for a couple of years. You know, and I've been asked why didn't your grandparents do anything? My grandparents didn't know. Like he didn't do it when my grandparents were around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then so what happened then was he beat me up. He was older than me. He was like 10 years older than me. And he threw me out. Our house had a screen door, and he threw me out the door, and I ended up taking the screen door with me. And then it hurt me. I was hurt. And I stood up, and I dusted myself off, and I left. I left home. I left home when I was 12. And I went to Longhorn Dam, because I used to fish Longhorn Dam.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed at Longhorn Dam. There's a little tunnel on the south side of Longhorn Dam. Today, the trail runs through it. But back then, there was no trail that led to it. So I stayed there for like 2 days. I went to school all dirty, and I met my best friend Albert since seventh grade. And I told him what had happened, and I asked him if he thought I could stay at his house. And he said he'd meet his mom. You know, he asked his mom. And so he asked his mom if I could stay, and they ended up staying over 3 years. That's where I lived, 12, 13, 14, and 15, was at my best friend's house. And they were very poor too, in that, you know, they really couldn't afford to take in another mouth to feed, but they took me in. And the reason I said that is because, you know, they themselves were living on food stamps. It wasn't like, you know, they had abundance, but they shared what they had with me, and so I'm grateful for that. Move the story forward. A couple of years ago, from that family, one of my brothers, my brother Max, because I refer to them as brothers and sisters, because mm-hmm. I became part of the family. My brother Max died of cancer, and I hadn't seen I refer to her as my third mom. I consider myself to have four moms and three dads,
mm-hmm.
because I lived with different families growing up. And so when I saw her, she saw me from across the room. When I first got to the house, and she stood up and she walked over to me, and all she said was, "I don't know why I said yes, but I'm glad that I did." And she gave me a great big old hug. And she's basically telling me, you know, she was a mom to me and she took me in as a son. And that's how I ended up with that family. And so, and we're still close, even now. We're still, you know, they're family. A couple, maybe like a month ago, I was helping my brother Albert, my best friend, helping him find a house to live in. Because he's a retired military, and he's looking for his daughter's going to St. Edward's. And so he's here. You know, they're going to stay here while she's in college, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's nice.
So that's that. Did that answer your question?
Yes. So, well, I guess I'm going to be asked this, but, like, by your parents, like, what was it like growing up, you know, you kind of went through that.
Yeah, that's kind of hard to really describe because I didn't really have parents.
Yeah.
And people don't, like, when I say that, you know, everyone first says, yeah, you must have had parents.
Right.
No, I didn't. And so, you know, I was kind of a lost soul in that way.
Yeah.
But I made up for it. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you here in a little bit what I did. There's a question there that I'll tell you what I ended up doing.
Okay. So, what advice would you give your teenage self?
Wait. Don't rush.
In any situation.
Yeah. Particularly in the areas of sex, love, and marriage. I would say wait. Mm. And I came up with a number. Don't ask me why this number pops up, but it's 26. Don't do anything till you're 26.
Okay.
Because by that time, you know yourself a lot better. You're a lot more prepared to accept someone into your life than you are when you're 17 or 18, which is what I did. I got married at like a month before my 18th birthday, and I already had a child that was a year old. And not that I regret that, because I don't, but life was hard, you know, when you're that way. And, you know, I just graduated high school, and it was just tough. But, you know, I could analyze you as to why I did that, but the reality is that if I had to tell myself again, I would say wait. Love with all your heart, but don't do anything that's going to cause you to stay permanent, at least not till you're 26. Mm. Can you fall in love at 20 or whatever? Absolutely. Can that happen? Can you find your soulmate? Absolutely. But I would think with the divorce rate of over 50% in this country, I would say wait. Take your time.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. We can die at any moment, right?
Mm.
We can, you know, who knows? You can walk outside and get hit by a car. But whatever. But if you can wait, just wait. Wait till you're 26. When you're 26, let yourself loose and just go. By that time, you've either finished college or you have a career going, and you can do whatever you want.
Mm.
But the most important part of that is that you know yourself better. And that's the most important part. You have to know yourself. You don't know yourself when you're 19. You don't. Definitely don't know yourself when you're any younger than that. And there's people who are, you know, in their 30s who don't know what they're about or what they want or what they're going to chase.
Mm.
You know, so I mean, that's why, you know, 26 seems to be the age that I think, once you turn 26, keep it in your pants, you know, love, but don't do anything that's going to make you want to, that's going to make you want to stay wherever you are at 24 or 25. Wait till you're 26.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Yeah. Sweet. So what are you most proud of personally and professionally in your life?
There are two things. One was when I was 19, I met a monk, a brother, a Catholic monk. And he asked me to go to a Bible study. And I had been curious about God and the Bible. I mean, just curiosities that I had. So I went to this Bible study that he invited me to. And what happened was I ended up studying for 11 years. And at this Bible study, the very first Bible study I remember, because I argued with him, it was Old Testament scripture, and it was talking about how the armies should melt their swords and make plows to feed people, more so than to fight wars. And growing up in East Austin, it was kind of a rough time, kind of a rough neighborhood. So my mentality was, no, you have to keep weapons because you live in East Austin, and you have to defend yourself because there's, you know, there's robbers and muggers and things out there. But I argued with him on that, and then over time, I got to see his point. And so, like today, you know, I'm you know, anti weapons and anti guns, not fully, but just you know, I do understand the point of self defense, but like the assault rifle issues that we're having, totally against people having assault rifles.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. You're not there to hunt people at war. They're not to hunt deer. You know, there's deer rifles for that, but. But that's just one thing that came from that. But the most important part that I'm most proud of professionally is when I met the monks, we founded myself and a few other teenagers and the monks a youth center called Our Lady. First it was called Our Lady's Youth Center, and then it became Our Lady's Family Center because we had to adjust to the fact that we weren't just ministering to youth. We have to end up ministering to the whole family. So it was a group of kids from East Austin. It was 12 of us, and we we started Los Jóvenes de Juan Diego, and our job was to do Catholic youth evangelization, which normally you don't hear of Catholics doing evangelization. We think of Protestants as evangelists. But we were trained and taught, and we went out and did missions and did services and did retreats and did, and then we ended up getting a building and housing what we used to do out at other places, housed it at Our Lady Family Center, which was on 6th and Chicago. And I ended up staying there 11 years, did all kinds of programs. We did, when you start working social justice issues, you realize that you don't just need to give people scripture and that they're better. You have to learn to give them services or provide services, and at the same time, educate them so that they can do that for themselves. And so that was the thing that we did, and we did that for a long time. I was one of the founding fathers of the program, and then developed a few other programs, and then we studied other programs that are already in existence, like for instance the Boy Scouts of America. And then we used the Boy Scouts of America for an explorer post, but it was a Catholic based explorer post. And then we used, because we were teaching scripture and Bible, we used what they refer to as the Baltimore catechesis method for teaching religion. And then we did things like the Learning Club, which was also out of I think it was Pennsylvania. There was a group in Pennsylvania that would help low-income kids. They provided them a place to do homework. And so we would go out and get mentors to help the kids do homework. Also, depending on what grade they were in, we would buy materials to help them along with the grade that they were in so that they could stay at level, because one of the biggest problems we saw was a lot of the kids were being left behind and they couldn't keep up with their schoolwork, and then they end up getting in trouble with school and making bad grades, and then by middle school and high school they dropped out. And in Austin, we had about a 60% dropout rate in East Austin. And I can't tell you that we knocked it down, but I can tell you that the kids that we worked with, a lot of them went to college. In fact, just this past May, one of the kids called me. He after graduation in high school, he went to join the military, and I think he did it for 6 or 8 years. He was a Marine, and then he came back, and he used the GI Bill to go to college. And he graduated from the same networks just this past May. You know, and that's pretty cool. We have another one that went to and became a doctor in the group. Mm-hmm. And then there's a few others just got degrees and, you know, just work. But a lot of the kids that we worked with have gone further than they ever imagined they could go. But it had to do with the foundation that we set before them to be able to go there. And then also, I'll give you a little story. So I love KISS, and Gloria and I went to go watch KISS at the Frank Irwin Center. And across the street from the Frank Irwin Center, there was a Denny's diner.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we didn't want to fight traffic, so we just walked across the street to have breakfast, or like a breakfast, but it was already at the KISS concert at night.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting there at the table, and I tell my wife, I said, "Hey, Gloria, you see that guy over there? He keeps looking at me. I think he likes me." And I'm joking.
Yeah.
I think he likes me. And she goes, "Why do you say that?" I said, "He keeps looking over here. He keeps looking at me." And she goes, "Hon, stop being silly." And I said, no, I'm being serious. He is. He keeps looking at me." And then as we get our ticket and we're about to leave, he walks over to the table. And he says, "Are you Fido?" And that was the name that they called me at the youth center.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Yeah, I'm Fido." He says, "I don't think you remember me, but I want to thank you." And I said, "For what?" He goes, "Because of you and the work that you guys did, I'm about to graduate from UT. But it's because of y'all. Because y'all did it for me." And I thought, wow, thank you. And so that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, and another story that comes from that is my big brother, John, from the Big Brother, Big Sister program, he gave me about 10 and a half years, from about 7 and a half to 18. That's how long he could be my big brother. When I started to do the work at the family center, I immediately made a commitment to be there for 10 years. And that was the way to pay him back, to pay back John for what he did for me. And what he did for me was save me. Mm-hmm. That's what he did for me. He may not realize that, but he saved me. Because where I was growing up was not conducive to having a good, productive life. But him taking me out of the neighborhood every couple of weeks, taking me to go see a different way that people live. He will take me camping. He'd take me fishing. He'd take me to go, you know, sporting events. You know, he'd take me just on vacation with his family. And that's my fourth mom. And he's my third dad. Mm. I talked to him one day. I had just turned 18. I remember the conversation. I said, hey, John, I know, you know, you've done a lot for me, and I appreciate that, and I'm thankful. What can I do to repay you back? And his response was, you can never pay me back. You can never do for me what I did for you, which is his response. And I'm thinking, okay, so what can I do? And he says, just do for someone else what I did for you. And I said, okay. I was 18 at the time. Mm-hmm. I went off and I did the youth center thing. I did it for 11 years, a little bit more than I had expected. But I was about to leave, and I was sent to Laredo to learn a retreat in Laredo to bring back a retreat called the Choice Retreat. And I had set a goal to do 12, and I was on my 12. But I was also on my way out of the family center because my 10th year had already come and gone. And so, and I made a commitment for 10 years. So after that, I could leave whenever I wanted to. And so what I did is I learned this retreat. I brought it home to the family center. And there was a talk in there called the parent/teen relationship. And so I asked him if he would do the parent role and I would do the teen role, even though I was an adult and he was an adult. And he said, yeah. And so we did the retreat. And the retreat's a three-day retreat. Starts Friday night, Saturday, and ends on Sunday afternoon. And so he was there for us during my talk. And then he was there for us during the end of the retreat. And then, so he got to see what I did, what I was doing. And then, a year later, maybe 2 years later, mom number four died of cancer. Mm-hmm. Her name is Dorothy. And she, so of course, you know, she's my mom, like a mom to me. So I went to the funeral and all. And then we were at Memo's house, which is his mother-in-law's house. I called her Memo because she was like a great-grandma, right? And we were there, we were sitting outside, and he looks at me, and he says to me, hey, I said, yeah? And he goes, that thing you did. And I'm like, what thing? He goes, that youth group thing you did. I said, yeah. He goes, how many kids do you have? How many kids do you work with? I said, are you asking about my program that I was in charge of, or are you asking about the whole program? He goes, the ones you were in charge of. I said, I worked with 702 kids. He says, how do you know? I kept a log. I did. I kept a log.
You still have that?
No. I don't have that. a lot of things got lost since then. But he says to me, you paid me back. Now, you have to understand, from 18 until like 40, there was no conversation about that. We never talked about that. Mm. But for him to have that on his mind, you know, 20 years later, 22 years later, you know, it meant that our conversation mattered to him. Mm. And he remembered that conversation. But of course, when that happened, you know me, you know, I get all teary-eyed and stuff. Because, you know, it meant something because he remembered our conversation. Mm-hmm. And that was cool. That was really cool. I was most proud of the work that I did at the Family Center. I did a lot of stuff at the Family Center. Worked with lots of kids. And my kids were 702, but literally there were thousands of kids that came through there. And although I didn't have a direct hand on each and every one of them, I had a direct hand in all the programs that they were involved in and all the things that we did, being that I was considered the founding father of the whole program. I helped a lot of kids. But I also know that at 11 years, sacrificing everything, it was time for me to go and start to live my own life. And so what I did is when I had my going away party in January, in February, which is just a couple weeks later, I went and I applied at Dell Computer. Now you have to understand I've been doing youth ministry for 11 years, right? And I went to Dell Computer. And, at the time, it was called Dell Computer. Mm-hmm. It changed its name a few times since then. But walked in, I was at the lowest of the totem pole as far as positions. And I was getting paid very, very little. But within 2 years, because of all the skills that I had learned at the Family Center and all the things that the monks, the brothers had taught me, in less than 2 years, I was an operations manager at Dell. I'm very proud of that, too. Mm-hmm. And I was able to stay there just shy of 14 years. So I'm very proud of that because that's a dog-eat-dog kind of world.
Yeah.
But I was able to sustain that for a long time until all of manufacturing was shut down and sent away. Then there was no place for me to work at Dell. But I gave it my best shot, and I did really good. So I'm really proud of that, too. You know, and now I know and I believe that I can do anything I set my heart to. And if I was to give someone advice as a teenager, as my teenage self, is you set your heart on it, you can do it. You can't be stopped. You have to be unstoppable. Mm-hmm. But the whole Family Center thing, the youth center thing, when I look back at it, it's an amazing adventure. And then my whole career at Dell is an amazing adventure. But those are things that I set out to do, and I did them. And it led up, St. Francis says this, or actually Pope Innocent III or the second says if it applies to you, it applies to everybody else that comes after you. Like, technology can change and jobs can change, but the human spirit, if whatever it is you're doing applies to you today, it's going to apply to people 1,000 years from now. And that's the reality. It doesn't change. Sure, the marketplace can change and the demand for different kinds of skills can change, but being human doesn't change. You know, and so with that, I'd say whatever you set your heart out to do, go do it. You can do it. There's nothing that can stop you but yourself. And I would say I'm living proof of that. And so with that, I say whatever it is I set out to do, whatever it is I want to do, I'm able to do it. And that applies to everybody. It really does. And there's no magic formula to it. There's no magic spell. You just have to just stay focused and do it. And it's a reality for everybody. That's the way I do whatever I want to do. I do. Yeah. That's it. Hope that answered that question.
Do these programs, like those programs that you helped found, like they continue? Like they're still going?
They continued for about, after I left in 98, they continued for like another 6 years, 7 years. Mm. And so it wasn't able to continue further than that, at least here in Austin, because this is the one that I was involved in.
Right.
But it does. There are programs that continue with the monks in Mexico City that they took from here over there.
Okay.
Yeah. But not here in Austin. When you work with an institution that's as big and as powerful as the Catholic Church, they have a lot of say. And so there was an issue with liability. And so because of that, they no longer continue.
Okay.
They want their people in charge, and we weren't their people. We were outsiders doing work that they weren't doing.
Yeah.
And so, but now they do some of the work.
That's good. So
in that way, yes. But in the way that we did it, no.
So can you tell me one of your happiest memories?
My happiest memories. Mm. You know, some of those, I would have to say, are when my kids were born.
Oh.
I had a total of five. Those would be some of the happiest moments. But I think...
Any, like, specific ones, like, with those kids?
Yeah. It's really hard to pinpoint one, because I really do have a lot. But then I have a lot of kids that are not my kids that were like at the youth center,
mm-hmm.
and I got to see them grow, and I got to see them change and develop. And so, I have countless happy moments for that I felt within myself, but that also came from others, and watching them. Now, I think the most recent ones is just watching Adam, currently just watching Adam grow and develop, and watching him go from, you know, an infant to now today he's going to be an 8-year-old, and just to watch his mind develop. And the happy moments are conversations that we have, and they're silly little conversations, but they matter to him. And I think a couple of weeks ago, he asked me a question. He goes, "Dad, what's the most important thing to know?" And my answer to him, I already knew it. It's most important to know God and to know yourself. And that was good, because right now he's in CCD and he's learning about God. And he's asking questions because he's learning about himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. So that's a happy moment. That's like one happy moment that took a few seconds.
Yeah.
And I have millions of those. I really do. But, you know, it's not that, like, when I got a new truck. It's not when I got, you know, those are happy moments. You know, when I got married, those are happy moments. But I seem to have more value, or I get more value out of experiences with people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, experiencing people grow, experiencing people change. Those are the things that I've come to value. You know, if I won the lottery, yeah, it'd be a happy moment. And it'd be nice. But happier would be to share it with people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are my kind of happy moments.
Okay. So what is something you're passionate about?
Something I'm passionate about? I was very passionate about the Family Center. Very, very passionate. I mean, it was my life. I gave everything to it. I didn't know what it was going to become. I didn't know how it was going to develop. I just knew that it was something that I needed to do and I wanted to do. And so I did it. Currently, my passion, it's a number of things. It's trying to be a good husband, it's trying to be a good father, trying to be good friends to people, trying to be a good brother. And you know, I love to fish, but I can't really say it's a passion, but I'll fish every chance I get. I love to spend time alone. That probably more so a passion. And because when I'm alone, I get to be me. And there's nothing more rejuvenating than being yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in a world where you're constantly bombarded by media and influences that, you know, ask you to be something else. And so when I get to be my own self, it's priceless to me. Is it a passion? It's probably as close to a passion as I can have. But I don't have a passion like that. Like, for instance, to say a service kind of passion where I'm doing something for others. I think with the ministries that I did do for the times that I did them, my passion has become my family. And my extended family, not just my immediate family, but my extended family. And just getting to reconnect with them and getting to be with them. You know, just like today, just hanging out here.
Mm.
But I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to watch a football game. I'm going to do an interview. But my passion is to be here. You know, could I be someplace else? Yeah, I could. But I'd rather right now just be here. You know, it's his family, it's tradition. You know, it's a day off of work. It's good to be home.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that I've come to learn is that, you know, when I say home, home's not a building. You know, I've had lots of homes growing up. And none of them were ever the house that we lived in. Home was always the people that I lived with. Whether it was my grandparents or whether it was the Juarez family. Because I also moved in with my big brother when I was 15. I went from my best friend's house when I was 15 to 18. Or until I was 15, I went to my big brother's house, John, from 15 to 18. And it's not the house. Like, everyone's moved from the houses that we call home. But the people moved. And when I go visit them, I'm still home, but they're not in the same house.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said something. I put something on Facebook. I said, everyone's got someone they call home. I put that on Facebook and on Instagram because that's the way that I see it. Everyone, you know, home is not a place. Home is the people. And I've come to understand that. And so when I say that, I know exactly what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's got someone they call home. It doesn't matter who you are. You could be a homeless person out in the street, and there is someone that they look forward to seeing, and that's home. But I guess home can be anything. But for me, home is people. That's my passion, is to be home with people. How much more time do you have?
I've got 7 minutes, but I think I can just do another one.
Okay.
Yeah. You have the next question?
Yeah.
Great. So, can you tell me when you, like, the most difficult moments in your life?
That's an easy one. The most difficult moment in my life. Well, there were two. One of them was the day that my son died. His name was Matthew. He was 42 days old, and he died of SIDS. At home, in his crib. And that was probably the most difficult day. And I want to emphasize day. Because it lasted one day. And so, but I can tell you that I lost a whole entire week. So the next week we were preparing the whole funeral. We had to do the autopsy. You have to go back to the fire department coming to the house, EMS coming to the house, then transporting him to the hospital working on him, then having to come tell us that they weren't able to save him, and then going to the funeral home to do funeral arrangements, and then going to the church and having to deal with the church for burial, and then having to go back to the funeral home and having to do the whole burial with the cemetery, getting all that lined up. I was directly involved in all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember it. I don't remember a lot of it. Every now and then, I get glimpses of it. And so that would be the most difficult day. The most difficult time would be, I think, now that I've had time to look back, I think the most difficult time was when, because of my son's death, it put a lot of pressure on my first wife and I. A lot of things that we didn't know how to deal with and didn't know how to handle. And it caused us to separate, and it caused us to divorce. And it caused us to lose our home, our house. It caused us to lose everything because we went separate ways. And I lost a real connection with my kids and my first wife. Yes, I'm their dad. Yes, they're my daughters. But I can't tell you that we have the greatest relationship. Because when you're no longer in the home, that kind of takes you away. So that lasted a lot longer. Like, the death of my son was a hard day. But I say that the divorce was the hard time. And the reason is because it lingers. A divorce doesn't happen in one day. The separation of people happens over time, and their spirits happens over time. But more importantly, the thing that we had to deal with, that I had to deal with, was that I had to readjust and relearn my role as a divorced father, as a divorced husband. And so my identity had changed, and I had a real hard time. Because I was fulfilling roles. I was a father, I was a husband, I was a provider. And then in no time, I was none of those things. It seemed to me like that got taken away. And although, yes, I was still a father, but I was a father from far away. No longer intimately involved with my kids' lives or my ex-wife or living in the same home. And so that lingered a long, long time. When I think about the death of my son and I compare it to my divorce, I find that my divorce was a lot more painful and a lot more hurtful because it lasted a lot longer. It wasn't a one-day event. And I think, I have friends, even just recently, who have started to go through a separation or a divorce. And I tell them, I say, listen, this is going to be really, really difficult for you. And I said, in order for you to understand what's going on, these are some of the things that may happen, and you have to deal with these things. Because when you don't, you can't move forward until those things are dealt with. Now, I didn't know that at the time. I learned that afterwards. And I learned it because, being Catholic, I had to go through an annulment to marry my next wife, which is Gloria. And the annulment was a 7-year process for me. And but in those seven year process, they get deep into your first marriage. I mean, they ask questions that are really deep, really personal. They question friends and family around you. It's not easy. But I was able to achieve that, to accomplish it. And so, but through those questions, there was a lot. The process is the process of healing, and you don't realize that until after you're in it. After you're in the process, you don't realize that it's for you to heal. I think I look at my friends around me who have been divorced and separated, or who can't even have a relationship, a steady relationship for whatever reason. They're constantly breaking up with boyfriends or girlfriends or whatever. I think it's because they've never dealt with the core of their issue. And doing the annulment process through the Catholic Church, it only allows you to deal with the core of the issue. You know, that's where it takes you. And until you deal with that, you're not going to be able to move forward. And so you're going to keep doing the same patterns you've done before. And so today, because of my annulment, I believe that I let all that behind and I don't carry it with me, and I'm able to have a healthy marriage with my wife today. But it took that. It took work. And so, you know, that's a good thing. But I think that that those are probably the most difficult times in my life, the saddest memories. Mm-hmm. You know, my little boy will be 30 now, just last month. But he'll be dying in about 3 weeks, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, so, yeah, tough times.
I feel like we could stop this at right now. Okay. We'll do another one.
That's fine. Did y'all learn anything from it?
Of course.
About me.
Yeah, because I didn't know about your... Oh, it's still fun. I'll be able to resume this.